Mr. Jonathan Bowden.
Fame at last. I was going to auction the wine, but the wine's disappeared, so I've come up for nothing. But now to start off, I do have, and this is all for the party, that I get nothing for it, various DVDs of me speaking, although some of you will have seen me speaking before, in Blackpool and in Blackburn. These were done by people down in the southeast. People should always be notified. Alan Bailey is on the back here, is a short chap with no hair, so you'll see him sat next to me. One of his relatives was Sir Oswald Mosley's bodyguard a long time ago in the East End of London. Lynn Green did the photography, and I think somebody called Danny Southall did the design, so they should all be mentioned. Now, driving through Manchester earlier on, you can see what's happened to this city. You can see what's happened to many other of our great industrial and post-industrial cities. They are in terminal and endless decline. They are full of immigrants. Their social amenities are rotting away. They have Labour rotten borough leaderships that only represent themselves and small cliques and related circles. There's going to be quite a bit of activity in the gay zone, or gay village, down in the centre of Manchester now, because civil partnerships have just become law. So there'll be quite a few pseudo-wedding ceremonies down there, no doubt. Because, unfortunately, the American model prevails in our declining metropolitan and municipal areas. So what's happening is that as the white population, working class and middle class, because Manchester's middle class went to Cheshire, as everyone knows, a long time ago, which is why there isn't a Tory virtually anywhere in the city at representative level, they've gone, and the white working class is partly left and has partly spread out to get away from the immigrant concentrations in the centre. But just like these cities in the US, like Atlanta and others, that went down the toilet for a while, there was an attempt to revive them. With rinky-dink flats for yuppies right in the centre, with warehouse apartments and blocks, with alternative society and scene-type zones, such as the one I mentioned before, and for sort of alternative white left types to drift back into the centre of the city and enjoy, in a sense, the slight decadent frisson in relation to what it's become. And they spend a lot of money, they tend to be single people, and they revive, in inverted commas, the decaying centres of burbs, of urban areas, as they go down. And it's happened in the United States for the last 40 years. The United States imprisons 2 million people. 2 million at any one time. And 80% of those in prison are black or of mixed race. The average life expectancy of a black male in an American city, particularly in Washington DC, which is also the capital of a worldwide empire, is 26 and a half. That's their average lifespan, given a mixture of gun crime, gangster rap, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, car chases, and so on and so forth. They're also policed essentially by their own kind, because nobody else wants to. Now, Manchester and Liverpool and Birmingham, where there was interracial rioting that just totally excluded us recently. I don't know if you noticed, but Asian and black gangs took parts of the city over for an entire weekend and rioted against each other, attacking the police, attacking all civic amenities. It gradually died down. This was allegedly over an incident that was spread by dissidents and illegal or illicit radio stations, which sort of broadcast with sort of Rasta DJs from the backs of people's flats and this sort of thing, and are periodically raided by the police. There's one of them in Manchester. One of these late night things, which is a Muslim radio station, partly pirate, maybe a few grants as well. They've just been fined £125,000 for racial incitement. But I'm not aware of which group they were inciting hostility against. It may have been Afro-Caribbeans, may have been Jews, I'm not sure. But as you can see, in relation to those events in Birmingham and partly elsewhere, we've been completely excluded. When there was a panel of people to discuss this inter-ethnic violence, there virtually wasn't a white individual on it. Because, of course, what's happened is people have come from all over the world and they've brought their beefs, they've brought their grievances, they've brought their feuds, and they act them out here on our streets. I was in Manchester about a year after the racial rioting occurred in sort of 1980-81, when Whitelaw, who was then Thatcher's sort of interior minister, as they say in France, said it had nothing to do with race at all. Large areas of Liverpool and a bit of Bristol as well, and Manchester all went up, were all torched as various gangs and others fought with themselves, fought with the Greater Manchester Police. Nothing to do with race. Property prices went down so you could buy a council flat house of the terrorist type of the sort that appears on the credits of Coronation Street for £1,800, for £2,500, for £4,000 in parts of Gorton and Moss Side where the riots occurred. But it had nothing to do, you understand, with race. And partly, these people were rioting amongst themselves. But when I was in Manchester, on the Oxford Road, which is at the heart of one of the biggest educational districts in Western Europe, I saw two Iranian groups, because the Iranian Revolution had just happened. And one of them was marching up and down screaming Khomeini, Khomeini, because they were supporting the new Iranian president who'd just flown in on a jumbo from France, where he'd been in exile from the Shah, a regime backed by ourselves and the United States of America. And Iran is important, because Iran is going to figure a great deal in the news in the next year to 2 years. So much so that, in my opinion, it will basically replace Iraq about a year and a half to 2 years from now. But there was another Iranian group on the Oxford Road as well, and they were members of the Mujahideen, which is a left-wing faction that was then backed by Iraq. And they were ranting against Khomeini and against the Islamic Republic. And the Greater Manchester Police were holding them apart. And I thought to myself, here are two Iranian factions, in their terms, right and left. In their terms, theocratic and religious and anti-religious or secular. But what are they doing fighting their brawls in the middle of Manchester, in the middle of one of our formerly great northwestern cities? And the reason is they've become part of the centre of Manchester, and they brought their wars, beefs and disputes, internal and external, here. And that's 25 years ago. There's been quite a bit of immigration into this conurbation and elsewhere over the last quarter of a century. Now, Iran is important because it's dangerous to make political predictions in meetings. But I'm going to make one. And I'm going to say that in the next 18 months there will be a devastating attack on Iran and on their nuclear facilities, which they're building under the mountains in the sort of southwestern part of the country. Who does it remains open at the moment. The Americans have an enormous amount on their plate in Iraq, but they're very concerned that the centrifuges are up and running and the Iranians are between 2 and 5 years from developing nuclear weapons. Yeah, don't kid yourself, they have a missile that can certainly reach Israel, and that is about 2 years, the El Hajaroun missile, from being able to reach Paris. And Paris is quite close to London. So there's a degree to which Iran is cranking things up, because 35 countries, according to the UN's Atomic Weapons Inspectorate, are on the threshold of developing full nuclear capacity. And why do other countries and other races want these weapons? They want them because they saw what happened to Iraq, where a country without weapons of mass destruction, because they destroyed the early programs under Saddam in the hope that it would prevent them from being attacked, was attacked and taken out by the US and their chief ally, namely Blair's United Kingdom, and you need nuclear weapons to offset the prospect of that. So Iran's well on the way to developing these weapons, and 90% of Iranians of all factions and all groups, Muslim or not, support patriotically Iran's desire to get these weapons. Israel may, in a subcontracting way, attack Iran on behalf of the United States, in which case F-16s would fly across Iraq in order to get there and get back, and they'd be refueled in the air by American tankers. They may, or they could, use nuclear-tipped missiles, deep-penetration missiles, to go into these bunkers and to destroy these nuclear facilities under the ground. Israel is quite serious and will do this even without American cognizance. If they fly over Iraq, we are complicit because we are occupying Iraq. We have a third of the country under our control, under our sovereignty. We've got our men there. If there is revenge for such an attack, and there surely will be, it will hit us and it will hit the United States. Of that, have no doubt. If they go over Saudi Arabia, they then conceptually overfly the holy places in Mecca and Medina, which will cause an enormous outrage in the Islamic world, which is in a great ferment regardless of that. Although probably they can get over Saudi Arabia, the Saudis will have their F-16s in the air by the time the Israelis get back. And they will have to fight their way through, and they'll probably lose some men and lose some planes, because those F-16s were given to the Saudis by the United States.
although the AWACS that will track the jets as they come back will be jammed by the US in accordance with their alliance with Israel. That will mean, technically, the possibility of a war between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which, although they are at a state of war, has never been hot before since the creation of Israel in 1948. Now, why does this all matter to us? Well, it matters to us because the world is shrinking. As globalization happens, as immigrants pour in of every hue and of every type, as the world gets mixed together, that which was one's neighbour's problem, that which was on the other side of the world, shrinks and comes here, and comes to the streets of Manchester, or Liverpool, or Derby, or Glasgow, or Birmingham. And it came to the streets of London, or the tubes of London, relatively a short time ago, in the middle of this year. Now, these were localised groups, quite small scale, quite primitive. One man with a bomb factory in Leeds that was so dangerous it took a week to demolish it to investigate by special police forces what they had in there. A couple of radical clerics who take hardline Muslims round from the mosque to another mosque, usually adjacent to it, so the rest of the community doesn't entirely get to see what's going on. 5,000 lads, British lads, nominally and allegedly, as the media would describe them, who've been to camps in Afghanistan when they were under the command of Taliban, that was financed by the Al-Qaeda network and Bin Laden personally, because it was a failed state. It was essentially a gang running a country, which is why the Americans took them out. Why they took out Iraq is more complicated and has to do with its rejectionist status in relation to Israel, its oil, and its key geopolitical vantage point in the Gulf. These things are real. We are living in a cycle of wars and revolutions as our people sleep, make money, watch television, besotted with sport, and hope for the best. But they're all thinking about it. Everyone in the country thought about it, if only for 2 to 5 minutes, when the bombs went off in the middle of London. Because almost everyone has travelled in those tubes or in public conveyances like it at one time or another. Everyone has, and if they haven't, they were going to, or their granny has, or their sister-in-law has, or somebody in their nuclear or extended family or circle of friends has done so in the past. Everyone could picture themselves in those tubes, because the young boys who blew themselves to pieces thought of themselves as soldiers, may have been even wearing military surplus gear under their civilian dress, because they think of themselves as soldiers. They're not suicide bombers, as the Israelis quite clearly say. If you want to commit suicide, you can go into the middle of a desert, you can go into the middle of Salisbury Plain and blow yourself up. They want to kill as many people as possible using their own body as a weapon, as a personal torpedo. And they want to do that because their civilization is at war with, pretty much, through their vanguard, with the people who are running our civilization. Now, why has this occurred? Every time you turn on the news, radio or television, the first 10 minutes are all about war, bombings, suicide bombings, more chaos in Iraq, people being strung up here, Western hostages, Bush says this, Israel threatens more bombings, Iran threatens to wipe Israel out. It's the first 10 minutes of almost every news item. But hardly any politician, from Blair down and around, ever comes forward to our people and says why this has occurred. Why are we partly at war with the Islamic civilization? Why have they been nominally attacking the West for the last quarter of a century? And why, in a sense, does the West fear them, and yet alternately has allowed millions of them to settle in Western societies? In France, just over the Channel, there was mass rioting of a sort that this country has rarely, if ever, seen, which went on at its epicentre for 2 weeks in the suburbs of Paris. In the last 5 years, according to TF1, which is the BBC One channel in France, 30,000 cars have been burnt out in the suburbs. Now, when we can think of suburbs, we think of leafy areas that the middle classes have gone to live in to get away from the mass immigration which has occurred in the inner city districts of most of our big cities. They deny that they've done that, but everyone knows that they have. However, in France, it's the other way around. Relatively rich and bourgeois people live in the centre, and the suburbs are for those who couldn't escape and for the immigrants. And they really are shut off, and they're zones, and they're worlds of their own. I once bought a map, because I was in Paris in 86, and you fold it out, this is one of these sort of tourist maps, and the centre of the city is beautifully marked. all the buildings, the Ile de Napoleon, where the great galleries are, where the great municipal structures are, but the suburbs are just a grey splodge, just a sort of grey smear around the central district, and that's where the immigrants are. There are 5 million Arab Muslims in France. 5 million. And most of them come from Tunisia, they come from Morocco, they come from Algeria, where France has an enormous history of war and revolution. In the early 1960s, the French government was almost overthrown by a right-wing officer's plot, if you like, from Algeria, involving a secret organisation within their own army, called the Secret Army Organisation, or OAS. Now, Monsieur Le Pen was a colonel in the paratroop regiment that fought in that war. Between 350,000 and 1.2 million Algerians allegedly died in that war. It's a big war. Very destructive. It's just on the margins of Europe. Millions of Algerians live in France. They're people who've fallen out with various regimes set up by Algerian nationalists, who are known as the FLN. And various elements of that society have gone to live in France as it's changed. 1.5 million white people lived in Algeria, which is what that war was all about. And they were forced out. 1.5 million French white people left within 2 weeks when the FLN came in the early 1960s. Within 2 weeks. Many of them torched their businesses before they left. And they left with everything they had. They're called Colon. They're called Pied Noir, Black Feet, because they were in North Africa. Many of them settled back in Marseille and in the southern parts of France. 70 to 80% of them and their children and their descendants vote for the Front National. The Front National support has gone up 5% since these riots. There is a very right-wing, go-list Minister of the Interior called Sarkozy. He's described some of the rioting immigrants in terms which can't be used on a platform like this, because it's blatantly illegal. But Sarkozy's deal and his intention is to stop Le Pen, as he admits to his own circle. Don't forget, the last presidential election in France wasn't left against right, wasn't one moderate against another, it was right against radical right, and the left voted for the less right-wing candidate to keep him out. Make no bones about it, France is near the brink. It's on the Security Council, it was a nominal winner in the Second World War, it's got nuclear weapons. In some ways, its economic model is in trouble, but still functions. It's a powerful Western society, but it's seen better days. 20% of the French Fifth Republic's population are, in the broadest of terms, non-white. Now, the BBC sent a journalist to meet the gangs who were torching the cars and rioting with the Central Riot Squad in the districts of Paris known as the suburbs. And they found a spokesman who came forward with his little woolly hat on, and he was from Algeria, and he shakes hands in the French way before he gives his spiel. And he said, "We hate France. We've got no hope here, we've got no jobs, they won't let us integrate, we don't want to integrate. We're with Islam. We're with Osama." A name he probably hadn't even heard a year or two before, but he's got off Western media. He said, somebody's got a Quran here, and one of them came out with it, holding it the wrong way round. And that sort of thing. We're at war with you. We're at war with the centre of the cities. We're at war. You ought to vote for people like Le Pen. Because we're at war with a lot of you. And his mates were around him, sort of cheering him, egging him on. Bravo, little claps, you know. This sort of thing. And what they've done, these lads, is they've internalised much larger disputes, which are global, which they're getting off the media. They get on their sort of third-generation mobiles, which they've stolen from some bourgeois woman in the centre of Paris, because most of these gangs are criminal gangs. They get pictures from Chechnya. They get pictures of Western troops being beheaded, and this sort of thing, which you can take down on various sites on the internet. And they think it's a wheeze, you see. It's their form of gangster rap. They think it's funny. They think it's amusing. But what has happened is they represent the lowest level of enormous tides of force which are washing all over the planet, and which are beginning to convulse us all. Because the Islamic civilization, which is partly racially based, is asking a great question of all of us, and of our culture, and of our civilization. Because they're saying that they want their own block, and they want to be separate. And I agree with that. And they're saying that Western society is irredeemably desperate and decadent. And I agree with that, actually. And they are saying that our civilization, certainly if it doesn't toughen up, is finished. And they will come in. There was a debate recently with some sort of radical Muslim warriors and those who theologically support them on Radio 4. All of them spoke perfect English. And they were talking to the BBC over satellite phones from places like Kashmir and Chechnya. And they said, you've just instituted a homosexual marriage. Which is quite true. That's the sense that happened last week. Your civilization's finished. Marriage is a man and a woman. Because it's biological. Your civilization is against God. And against that which is ordered. And it will finish. And we are coming with an answer. Because you have to understand Islam, theoretically, is a completely race-blind religion. All should convert. Which is known as the perfect state of Imam. There will be peace after justice, which is Islam. Now, what's happened is that all of the masses of the third world that had vanguard organisations in the 50s, 60s and 70s looked to the far left. They looked to a residual degree to Maoist China. They looked to the Soviet Union before its collapse in 1990. Don't have that anymore. Palestinian groups. 20, 30 years ago when I was a teenager, they were all leftist groups. Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, General Command, what a name, eh? Let's a bomb off today. Those groups don't exist anymore. They've been replaced by Islamist groups. They're the new current. They're the new wave. But why do non-whites, broadly speaking, including people who detest Islam, for reasons of their own tribal certainty, such as Indian Hindus, both groups committed genocides against each other in 1948 in India. Don't forget that. An Indian individual will walk a half mile on to go to a Hindu news agent, because he's not going to a Muslim one, because his parents and grandparents were forced over the green line between India and Pakistan when the two states broke apart by virtue of gangs relating to the other group. Don't forget all of the internal divisions within these. But Islam is coming in and a conquest of 100 years by some of the vanguard elements of these groups. So Islam is becoming a powerful mask and fist and glove around the fist for people who are anti-Western all over the world. It's the fastest growing religion in British prisons. Afro-Caribbeans are increasingly around the margins, and they're a very Christianized group, moving towards Islam. And they're moving to it for two reasons. One is because it's a rebellion against Western standards. Many criminals, when they're in the dock now, who virtually know nothing about this religion at all, if you ask them what the Hadith was, they wouldn't have a clue. That's the personal sayings of Muhammad. They wouldn't have a clue. But they sense it's rebellious, they sense it's anti, they sense it's against the West, and they couldn't even at times define coherently what the West was. But people, in a sense, define themselves by virtue of what they're against in this life, unfortunately, rather than what they're for. And that's a perennial yardstick in all groups throughout human history. When Mike Tyson came out of prison, charged with raping a black female model, he became a Muslim for 6 months. He was photographed all over the world coming out in regalia and dress from his maximum federal penitentiary. It was just another fad, and he's on to another thing, you know, 6 months later. But for a while, he turned his finances over to Farrakhan's Nation of Islam organisation. And he did that because he wanted to say, as he walked before the entire mass media of the world, coming out of prison, look, I'm not identifying with you, I'm identifying with the South, with the others, with non-whites, not with your power structure, but with ours. If you asked him theologically a couple of questions about the religion he's in for the moment, he wouldn't have been able to answer, because it's become symbolic of other things and other forms. But it's very powerful, because religion's far more powerful than politics, far more powerful than even national ideology at times, because it provides a structure for people to live and die within. It gives ultimate meaning and sanction, particularly to violence, because it is rooted in belief. What do our people believe in now? What do they believe in now? Christianity has collapsed. The educational yardsticks that used to empower our establishment and they imposed on the rest of the society, classical learning and so forth, all collapsed, all gone down the toilet. Vast stretches of our population know little of our history, little of our art, little of our architecture, little of our law, little of our science. 90% of all of the intellectuality of modernity has been created by white people. Essentially white men. 90% of it. But vast stretches of our population know nothing about our civilization. And have been completely de-educated and miseducated. Left-wing white people brought in comprehensive education to equalise things up, to make sure these invidious grammar schools and these nasty class sectarian examinations like the 11 plus were done away with. What has resulted is that you've had a mass dumbing down in relation to media and culture and knowledge and capacity for education. And it's just created passive, know-nothing consumers who do nothing and who think very little but are internally very worried as they see tube stations blown to pieces in their capital city. And people come up to me and say, why has it happened? And I said, well, the Islamic world's radicals have been fighting a war against the Western world for the last 25 years. They think our civilization is a total atheistic attack upon them. They don't want liberal secularism. They detest us for our support for the Israeli Republic. And they want to take this territory because they think we've got too weak to maintain it. Oh, all right. You know, and this is what many of our people are like. Because for the first time in our history, our people find themselves leaderless. The vast majority of our people voted Blair back, those that bother to vote, and Blair's resting on what? 35% maybe of the vote, which is really something like 22.5% of everyone in the society. The Tories got more votes in England than he did. When he's in Scotland, he claims to be Scottish. I didn't know that until a member of this party who is Scottish told me that. Of course, when he's down here, that's never mentioned. But people have worked Blair out now, but it doesn't matter because by the time people work him out, there'll be another one. Here's Blair with his wet handshake and his six promises, and he's so sincere he's going to write them in his own signature, his own handwriting, because I'm sincere. This sort of lying, secular, vicarish manner that he has, but has been caught out because Iraq was a step too far, because he lied too blatantly about Iraq, because he said there were weapons that they didn't have, that most people thought that they didn't have at the time, because Iraq was a sort of peculiar Byzantine regime. Many of Iraq's scientists lied to Saddam that they had weapons to get grants and favourable treatment, knowing that they'd have been slaughtered by a secret police had they found out. But Iraq was an easy target. There'd been sanctions on them for 12, 13 years. They had no spare parts for their military. The Americans took them in 3 weeks. 3 weeks! And their internal divisions in the Pentagon because they didn't take them in 3 days. This is the power America has. Enormous power. Unbelievable power. Helicopter gunships are flying tanks. Americans, most of them Christian, sit back and press a button in a B-52 and a missile, a cruise missile, goes out the bottom and it's got a computer in the nose cone. So it itemizes where it's going to strike. They're now using chemical weapons in Iraq. Now this is an irony really, because the chemical weapon they're using is called white phosphorus. And it's a new form of napalm, which they used extensively in the Vietnam War. Now this weapon, which burns down to the skin, and in other words, a human being when it lands on them becomes a human torch. That's the whole thing. The US Marine Corps calls it shake and bake. You fire off conventional rounds, and then you fire white phosphorus, and you alternate it. And then you send in the regimes to pick up the bodies, you know, and put them in bags. And then you burn them, contrary to Islamic tradition, but they're burned anyway. And don't forget, pictures of all this are going all around the world. They're going all around the world on Al Jazeera and Al Islamia and other Arab-based satellite news stations. And people wonder why certain Islamist youths are prepared to use themselves as weapons to attack people in our civilization. Because they see no difference at all between our people, the people in this room and elsewhere in Manchester and beyond this evening, as they paddle around and wonder what's on the football and all the rest of it. They see no distinction between them and Blair and Bush and the others. They don't even see any distinction between the white Western regimes that oppose the war, like the French and the Germans, and tacitly the Russians, and so on. But everyone gets what they want in this world in a strange sort of way. These insurgents in Iraq are using Chinese weapons, paid for by Iran, to attack our troops, of which they've killed over 100 in southern Iraq. And if Iran's attacked, our troops will be attacked in a far more ferocious way, because the Shia in the south will rise against us. And these things matter. It's not obscure nonsense involving foreign groups of which we need to know little, because millions of these people are living here. They're living in Manchester. They're living in Lancashire. They're living all around you. They're living in London. This is an organisation that essentially represents political dispensation of white people, of indigenous people. But it's a semi-underground organisation that meets in meetings via redirection positions and rendezvous and this sort of thing. When we had our AGM recently, right in the middle of London, it was essentially a semi-secret gathering with a rendezvous via the taxi rank of a particular mainline station and so on. That meeting, which certain organisers who are here tonight attended, of course, was 800 yards from Trafalgar Square, in a club with a double security door and all this, but surrounded by 20, 30 security staff members who guard the chairman and from the London security branch and so on. Now, in Trafalgar Square, which was just round the corner because the meeting place was off the Strand, central thoroughfare in the middle of London, radical Islamist groups and other foreign radicals living here have had major rallies within the last year, even a couple of months before the tube bombings, even involving parties that Blair says he now wants to ban. Because don't forget, there are certain radical Muslim parties in this country who don't stand for election. Democracy is contrary to Islam. It's filth and nonsense where people bribe you by saying they're going to give you more benefits or less benefits and so on, and you vote for a blue ticket or a red ticket. They regard democracy as utterly meaningless. There's a group in Iraq led by the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq called Monotheism and Jihad. Monotheism and Jihad means total God war. That's what his group means. Its leader, Al-Jakari, beheaded Ken Bigley on internet. He did it personally. These people get down and dirty. You know, they don't sit at the back and allow their men to go into battle. They lead them in. I was rather surprised in Robert Fisk's biography of Osama bin Laden, who, like it or not, is one of the major historical figures of the time that we're living in, as historians will delineate. Bin Laden was wounded 5 times in Afghanistan and lost 500 members of his own group fighting against the Soviet Union in alliance with the West, because they were atheistic communists who needed to be destroyed and because they'd invaded a Muslim nation. He's devoted his entire fortune, over £1 billion, to this struggle. He used to be a playboy. He used to hang around in bars, even visited this country. He's alleged to have gone and watched Arsenal once. But this was his decadent period before he had his conversion to total religion when he was 30 years of age. Now, whether the Americans succeed in killing him in a bunker in Afghanistan on the Pakistan border, which is probably where he is, doesn't matter. Because he's become a myth. He's become a symbol all around the world. I know a chap who teaches in a Muslim school in Luton, which is 90% segregated. And a boy, pursuant to nothing in particular, said his father had 2 portraits over the mantelpiece. And he said, oh yes, well, who were they then? And one was a Saddam Hussein, this was before the Iraq War, and another was Osama bin Laden. This is just a chap living in Luton. A third of all Pakistani boys have Osama in their name. Why? Because he's a hero, that's why! Because he attacked New York. Because he attacked America. Because, indirectly, he attacked London. But it's not mindless violence and nihilism, even though it seems to be that in the first instance. They are saying that they want a different form of life to us. And they've got a right not to bomb us, but to say they want to be different. Because I don't believe, and this party doesn't believe, in universalism. It doesn't believe that we're all the same. They are different, and they have a right to be different, because they are racially different, for the most part, from ourselves. And they culturalize that spiritually differently from us. No white people ever convert to a religion like Islam without force. The only people who have converted are in the Balkans. And they were converted either because they were in sects where Islam offered them a better deal than the Orthodox and the Catholics around them, or because it was at the point of a sword. But people don't stay with something if it's just forced on them, because there is a truth there. And Muslims believe that without God there is no meaning.
There is no personality, there is no individuality. That's why they'll sacrifice their own individual lives. It doesn't mean anything. To die for the faith is better than to live with dishonour. Fisk asked Osama in this interview that they had in this sort of bunker in Afghanistan. He said, what about somebody who steals and whose hand is cut off? What's your view of that? And Osama bin Laden, who's quite an educated man in his way, remained silent for 2 minutes. They were all completely silent around him. And then he said, the true Muslim would put his hand forward for it to be removed, because he knows in his heart that he is nothing and the religion is all. So it's the logic of totality. It's a sort of, it is a totalitarian belief system. It is in some ways the most quote-unquote right-wing and authoritarian religion on earth. It tells you which hands to eat food with, which hand to wipe yourself with, how to pray, how to kneel, how to make love to your wives. Osama bin Laden's got 16 wives at the moment, and he's had 167 children, all of whom are warriors of the faith. And they were despised. This is a society that's had, what, on the most conservative figures, 3.25 million abortions since the late 1960s. And they would say to us, it's just another symbol of your decadence and of your decline. If you don't want family life, if you don't want children, if you don't revere and honour them, we will replace you. This is what they're saying. And many of our people seem utterly blind to it in all circumstances. And there is a degree to which, and this is true of quite a lot of rightist and perennially minded people, and I'm not philosophically friendly to this, but many right-wing people are, actually admire elements of Islam for their belief, for their strength, for their ferocity, for their knowledge of who they are. Because unless we begin to recover as a people and as a nationality and as an ethnicity, a sense of who we are and what we have achieved and what it means culturally, and until we reignite and reanimate forms of belief and consciousness in who and what we are, and when we stop being afraid, because fear and risk aversion is endemic with our people at the moment because they're moderately comfortable, many of them. But the group that conquered a quarter of the planet is now in certain respects frightened. Their leadership is gone. Their soldiers strip naked and fight with each other illicitly whilst others look on dressed as women. And outside, people look at us and think, what are they doing, these people? I heard a Pakistani lawyer on the radio a couple of years ago, and he said, well, look, I'm an educated man, you know, but we don't want the West. You know, you turned against God, you're pro-homosexual, you've gone sex mad, all you care about is sport, your culture's gone down the drain, don't marry anymore, you don't have any more children. You know, I'm not racist, you know, this is the chap on the radio, you know, but look what you've done to yourselves. We don't want it for ours. And they're here. A significant proportion of immigrants have more conservative attitudes than our people. Because our people have got wet and soft. And far too liberal. Far too fluid. Far too reflexive. The other point of view is always right. Oh, one should always listen to everything. The truth is in the middle. And so on, you know. I knew I was in the Tory party for a long time, as people know. I know a whole crop of these new Tory MPs. I know them like people in this room. Gove, Goodman, all these people, I knew them. And you should hear what they said in private, as against what they're prepared to say in public. Gove said to me, Gove was an editor on the Times before he became an MP. He's not a totally important person, you know. Gove said to me, well, it's a disaster what's happened in this country, isn't it? But we can't say so, and we can't do anything. And I said, well, why can't we say so, Michael? And he's Scottish originally, he's from Edinburgh. And why can't we do anything? He said, well, it's un-British to do anything. I said, it's un-British to do anything. He said, oh yes, it'll cause trouble. It'll lead to conflict. I said, this country is based on conflict and conquered a quarter of the world. He said, ah, but it's incorrect to say so. This is like the Tory MP. You know. There's another chap called Paul Goodman who's become an MP. I was once at a dinner and Goodman was sat there. Goodman's a Jewish convert to Catholicism. He became a monk, but then he didn't like that. So he gave up and became a journalist, and now he's an MP. He wouldn't speak to me because somebody had told him I was a Nazi. So he wouldn't speak to me. I mean, it's a funny group, though, because a funny individual, because a group of Tories once force-fed him pork when he converted to Catholicism. So these Tory students get up to all sorts. You wouldn't believe it. But he's an MP now, and so are many of them. He thought I was a quote-unquote Nazi or quote-unquote fascist because I was known to have been a circle of people in a group called Western Goals that invited Le Pen over in 91. But all of these people, and don't forget, these are right-wing people in inverted commas. Left-wing students in the 60s would brick in windows, would burn bits of university campuses, would riot with the police if these sorts of people had a meeting. I kid you not. When Tebbit had meetings at polytechnics in London and so on, there was absolute riots in the 1980s. I seem to remember when the Jewish Home Secretary, Leon Britton, had a Manchester meeting at the NUS headquarters on the Oxford Road in Manchester, that there was enormous violence and the GMP battened the students down the steps and all this sort of thing in the early days of Thatcherism. These were the people they hated. These are the people who are around the Tory party now, because they were students then, they're middle-aged like me now. And they are as soft as putty, and they're frightened to say anything, and they're frightened to do anything. They'll oppose the euro, and that's about it. When their country is disappearing, when their cities are disappearing, when bombs are going off in their tube stations, and these people, these right-wingers, will do nothing, and will say nothing. And the people, and they hate this party, I can tell you for a fact. And they fear it. They fear the consequences of it getting somewhere. Because there'll be no time for people like them. No. There'll be no time for people like them. And the problem, even with people whose instincts aren't too bad, and I had a conversation with William Hague when I was 18, when he was 18, and he said, we can't do anything, you know, it's all over. They wouldn't listen to Enoch. It's gone. You know, we need a colour-blind conservatism. And I said to him, well, you have to understand, William, that people perceive life differently because they are different. Because all groups and all individuals aren't equal. Because hierarchy is endemic. Because everything is based on nature. And if you go against nature, it will sweep you away. If you build a city on a floodplain and don't have any dams, it'll flood it out. If you begin your married life in a urinal in Manchester, you will die of a sexually transmitted disease. Nature will destroy you over time, if you go against its norms, because all are rooted in it. And it is only when people realise these verities and realise that they must come forward to speak for them and to incarnate them that we will revive. Because we will revive. It's inevitable. Otherwise we will completely disappear. And our culture will be completely destroyed. A culture which has existed for thousands of years, which philosophically goes back to the Sophists before Socrates, 2,500, 2,600, 2,700 years ago. It's not obscure stuff that only elitist snobs know about. It is the culture that all white people's sense of themselves is based upon ultimately. One of the reasons our religions and some of our structures have collapsed is because we think more than most other groups. We dialecticize more, we debate more. Most Muslims just kneel in the dust and accept what is given to them. But we won't do that. But what we have done as a civilization is we've made a crucial mistake. We've become confused. We've become undisciplined. We've become lax and liberal-minded because it's all so complicated once you open things up. When you begin to debate the meaning of life, what truth is, what justice is, what beauty is, what law is, what evil is, it's all so complicated. Christianity didn't prove to be completely factually accurate, so it's gone down the bin. And most of our people, in some ways, are the worst for the fact that it's gone. And it has gone. Look around you. I'm not a Christian. I never was.
But there is a degree to which its collapse is a disaster for many of our people, because it was a structure. And human beings need structure and order. And our people need a new elite. But it's only an elite which will come forward with vigour and with strength. Because now and around this time is the time. And the people who come forward now will become historical figures. Make no bones about it. And they will be understood as such by those around them. Most people fear people in this party. They're frightened to vote for it. I had a chap in a meeting once who said to me, will they find out if I vote for you? I said, who are they? They don't give a damn who you are and who you vote for. Vote who you want. Or for whomsoever you wish. Cowardice is endemic with people. But the people who are not cowards will live forever. Classics is no longer taught in any of our schools, except the most elite schools for the very rich. But there was a philosopher called Heraclitus, 2,500 years ago, who said that the cowardly die and fade out and fizzle out like a firework going out in the sand. But those with courage live forever, in the minds of other men and in posterity. And this party is, on the mainland anyway, the most courageous party in the country. It is. People may not think it, as others were, don't go on to go out in the rain and the dark to leaflet in half-ethnic estates and so on. But the establishment is always aware of this party. They're always thinking about it. That's why it's not been mentioned in the media since the bombings. Except for the chairman's court case in Leeds. And that is deliberate, pretty much. Even though the media's chaotic and invasive and difficult, and they had to denotice the media to stop them mentioning that George Bush wanted to blow up Arab satellite television stations with cruise missiles and Tony Blair talked him out of it. And they had to denotice that because the media is chaotic. But the media knows where its enemies are. And that's why the media devotes programmes to getting 17% of the vote in Dagenham. Because they're frightened. Because the liberal elite knows that their ideas are false. And are untrue to nature. But what they doubt is whether a group or a party can come up that represents the instincts of white people and of indigenous people. And the only party that will do so, forget little fragments to the left or right of this party, forget UKIP and the others, the only party that stands, even amidst the welter of difficulties, any scintilla of a chance of reanimating our people and giving them new pride and governance and direction is the British National Party. Thank you very much.